This is Second Look. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director. Thanks for joining me for the show today. Stay tuned. We've got a lot of stories to review from the newsroom this week, including a look at competing health claims over raw milk, the private detention facility for illegal immigrants in Farmville, and one from the archives about an engineering professor at VMI who takes his students back to the old principles of timber framing. And we've got this week's Our Island Universe, too. But first, several events in September energized opponents of the proposed Atlantic Coast Natural Gas Pipeline, a successful Native American-led protest at least temporarily halting the Dakota Access Pipeline in North Dakota, a gasoline pipeline spill in Alabama that protesters say raised awareness of the dangers of pipelines, and a new study that says the proposed pipeline in Virginia isn't necessary. But there are questions about that study, and the pipeline still has its supporters on the ground, as WMRA's Jesse Nadler reports.
Sign-carrying protesters have been gathering near Dominion's offices in Stanton every Wednesday in September, seeking support from passing motorists.
So we have an election coming up, so we're hoping to remind our elected officials that people are going to vote no pipeline. We keep saying pipelines explode, and they explode a lot more frequently than people think.
Jennifer Lewis is the president and founder of Friends of Augusta, a local pipeline opposition group. She is referring to the rupture of a pipeline owned by Colonial that the company estimates has spilled roughly 300,000 gallons of gasoline in Alabama. Here's protester Bill Limpert.
Well, I find it hard to believe that their pipeline breaks and the public's going to have to pay for it through increased gas prices.
The Colonial leakage coincides with the federal government temporarily halting construction of a pipeline that was supposed to transport crude oil across the Dakotas after heated protests by Native American nations. Here's Jennifer Lewis again.
We are here also in support and solidarity with the folks fighting the Dakota Access Pipeline. We are very excited to see that the federal government is stepping in this situation.
Although both incidents are unrelated to the proposed 600-mile Atlantic Coast Pipeline that will carry fracked natural gas from West Virginia to Virginia and North Carolina, they both involve pipelines. And that has provided fresh grist for local opposition groups armed with a new report that concludes more pipelines running through the region aren't necessary.
We have so many pipelines that we don't need this pipeline.
The study found that existing pipelines are sufficient to supply more than enough fuel to power the region through 2030. These conclusions are not surprising, given who commissioned the study, points out Aaron Ruby of Dominion, the energy company behind the proposed Atlantic Coast Pipeline.
I think folks should take this report at face value. It's an anti-pipeline report paid for by anti-pipeline groups.
He's referring to the study's sponsors, the Southern Environmental Law Center and Appalachian Mountain Advocates. He points out that demand for natural gas in Virginia and North Carolina is expected to grow 165% over the next 20 years. Existing natural gas pipelines, some 2,200 miles of them already crisscrossing the state, are already operating at full capacity.
The authors don't seem to understand how the natural gas pipeline system works. What they've basically done is they've looked at, as a region, as a whole, there may be available capacity on some of the pipelines. What they haven't done is demonstrated how any of that available capacity could actually be transported to the regions where it's needed.
In Hampton Roads, Virginia, for example, natural gas usage has already been hindered for large industrial customers during peak demand periods. In North Carolina, currently one natural gas pipeline serves the entire state. Scott and Ann Seaton of Waynesboro say protesters represent a very small but very vocal minority in the debate. Most Virginians, they say, recognize the need for more power to support Americans' energy-hungry lifestyles.
This is a bipartisan-supported concept, with knowing that if Virginia is getting down in the ranks as a business-friendly state, one aspect, our lack of power. Governor McAuliffe, Democrats and Republicans see the need for this pipeline and are supporting it.
So what I would like to see is a lower price energy, more businesses come to our area so that our children can stay in our areas, have good-paying jobs, instead of having to go find those good-paying jobs elsewhere.
Dominion announced it has signed a construction contract with Spring Ridge Constructors to build the pipeline, even as the project awaits approval by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. But as the Virginia Supreme Court agreed last month to hear an appeal against the pipeline, protesters say they aren't going anywhere. Bill Limpert's home in Bath County sits right in its path.
We bought it for our retirement, and now the pipeline's proposed to cut it right in half. The trees there are between 140 and 160 years old, so they haven't been cut since the time of the Civil War.
For WMRA News, I'm Jesse Nadler.
In Virginia, as in most other states, the retail selling of unpasteurized milk is illegal. But it is legal in the state for cow owners to drink raw milk from cows they own. And that's the loophole in the law that allows the sale of raw milk to owners of shares in the herd. Whether or not drinking raw milk is a good idea or should be a matter of personal choice depends on whom you ask, as WMRA's Christopher Clymer-Kurtz reports.
As the sun rises over a small garage along a country road near Kieseltown, Windy Hill Farm owner Corrine Warnes organizes empty half-gallon jars. The people who drink the milk from her couple dozen currently milking cows are not her customers. They are part owners of the herd. They've bought shares of the cows. One share equals 2 gallons of milk each week, and they pay ongoing boarding fees.
When they are a herd owner, they get the benefits of that, and one of the benefits is milk.
Until May, Warnes mainly shipped milk through a conventional distributor and sold herd shares on the side. Her shipper, Dairy Farmers of America, knew about that for years, she says, but in May dropped her contract.
I didn't feel like we were hurting anybody. I felt like we were giving people a choice. It was breach of contract, and it just push came to shove, and we had to stop what we were doing.
Without that contract, they had no outlet for much of their milk. Unlike faucets, you can't just turn off cows.
Just to open that tank and watch hundreds of gallons of milk go down the drain, it was really stressful. It was tough. It was something my husband and I didn't talk about, just because it's all your work. You know, you work so hard. He does this before school. He gets up at 4:30, milks, goes and teaches school, comes back. And just to watch it go down the drain is just breaks your heart.
They began actively promoting herd shares. They've sold more than 60, but they need more in order to be sustainable.
We're still dumping milk down the drain.
Naysaying public health heavyweights decry drinking raw milk. The websites of the Centers for Disease Control, the Food and Drug Administration, and the Virginia Department of Health call raw milk one of the riskiest foods that can harbor dangerous microorganisms that can pose serious health risks to you and your family.
It can carry bacteria that can make you sick, like Salmonella, E. coli.
They say there is no scientific evidence for many of the health benefits claimed by proponents. Eric Paulson of the Virginia State Dairymen's Association, an organization that advocates for dairy farmers at the state and local level, adds that drinking raw milk doesn't come down necessarily to a matter of personal choice.
In over two-thirds of the cases, there's a child involved. That's really what worries us, is that the children don't always make the choice.
Compare the numbers, though, to those of smoking, which kills 480,000 people in the United States each year, including nearly 42,000 from secondhand smoke exposure, and is still legal in Virginia. But in our state, it's not legal to buy and sell raw milk for human consumption, even though nationally, in the 14 years from 1993 to 2006, there were just 2 deaths linked to unpasteurized milk. Paulson and government agencies insist that pasteurization makes milk safer to drink without significantly reducing its health benefits. But raw milk advocates heartily disagree.
I would just assume buy soda.
Charlottesville's Nancy Hurlbrink is a shareholder of the Windy Hill Herd. A lot of the milk she buys for her 4-person household ends up as yogurt or kefir.
We easily go through 5 gallons a week and sometimes we run out. And I have twins who are 9. They've been drinking raw milk since they were 1, and they're in great health.
She references the health claims of raw milk proponents like the Weston A. Price Foundation, which says that raw milk has its own built-in protective components for dealing with pathogens. Furthermore, the foundation says, pasteurized milk is linked to, among other ailments, lactose intolerance, allergies, autoimmune disease, and attention deficit disorder. Hurlbrink adds that buying locally from farmers she knows is a vote for her kind of world, where animals aren't crowded and don't need antibiotics, where milk keeps its good bacteria, and farming doesn't cause massive pollution.
It's not just about what you pay at the checkout.
Back on the farm, the mostly Jersey cows wander into the noisy milking parlor when they're ready for some grain and their once-a-day milking. In the next room, Corrine Warnes fills the sterilized jars from the stainless steel milk tank. Raw, she says, is how milk is supposed to be.
One time we came back really late from a trip, and we stopped at 7-Eleven on the way home and bought a gallon of milk. And gave the kids cereal the next day. We're like, what is wrong with this? I'm like, No, that's not what's wrong with it. That's what other people drink when they buy it from the grocery store. We're spoiled.
For WMRA News, I'm Christopher Clymer-Kurtz.
Farmville, the home of Longwood University and site of last week's vice presidential debate, and also a private detention center for hundreds of illegal immigrants. Earlier this year, officials from the United States Department of Justice announced the department's decision to discontinue the use of private prisons for federal prisoners. But even under the new policy, immigration detention centers like the one in Farmville remain unaffected. WMRA's Sefe Imakpai gives us a closer look at the facility in Farmville and how it operates.
The U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Washington Field Office is located in Farmville, Virginia.
The Farmville facility is very different than what most people would consider a traditional jail environment.
Matthew Monroe is assistant field office director and says out of more than 500 current detainees, well over 90% have criminal convictions. But after having served their time, these detainees are no longer federal prisoners per se, but rather illegal immigrants awaiting deportation.
We are detaining individuals because, yes, some of them are threats to the community and are public safety risks, but the primary functionality is we detain people to effect their removal from the United States. Because these people are not in a punitive functionality setting, they are provided a higher level of benefits and programs than a lot of people who are serving punitive sentences.
According to Monroe, those programs range from second language classes to GED instruction, religious services, and even volunteer opportunities.
We provide them medical care, mental health care if it's required, access to Alcoholics Anonymous, GED program.
In August, the U.S. Department of Justice announced it would discontinue the use of private prisons for federal prisoners. The decision came after it was determined private prisons were both less safe and less effective. As it stands, the decision does not affect private immigration facilities like the one in Farmville. But that could change as well. A statement from the Secretary of Homeland Security, Jay Johnson, reads, "I directed our Homeland Security Advisory Council to evaluate whether the immigration detention operations conducted by ICE should move in the same direction. Specifically, I've asked to establish a subcommittee to review our current policy and practices concerning the use of private immigration detention and evaluate whether this practice should be eliminated." While not commenting on the issue of private versus federal operation, Monroe says safety at the Washington field office is a top priority, and the facility continues to operate under the highest detention standards.
Detainees are classified based on criminal history, past disciplinary history, and all of that information is used to determine a classification level for them. They may be anywhere from a low level, that's what we consider a low classified detainee, to a high classified detainee, and then detainees are housed with similar classification levels.
But he says despite all necessary precautions, incidents do happen.
We do have the guards that are with the, inside the dorms and the program areas with the detainees, and it's just a matter of, you know, detainees, the individuals getting along with each other. There are, unfortunately, personality conflicts, and, you know, we have to do the best to manage that as we can.
With a current capacity of 642, the Farmville facility is looking to expand its population. The Secretary of Homeland Security is expected to receive a final review of ICE private facilities no later than November 30th. For WMRA News, I'm Sefe Imakpai.
Civil engineers build roads, bridges, canals, heavy-duty stuff. It's what you'd expect to learn at a school with a strong engineering program, like at the Virginia Military Institute in Lexington. But one civil engineering professor there has taken the construction process way back for his cadets, we're talking thousands of years, by teaching them how to timber frame, in the process, exposing them to a much wider world. WMRA's Jesse Nadler has this story from September 2015.
It's a sunny Monday, and Colonel Greg Mullen, Jr., a professor of civil engineering at VMI, is teaching his wood engineering class to a group of cadets out on the parade grounds. The cadets, clad in crisp white uniforms with high, tight haircuts, are tasked with assembling a small-scale timber frame. a wood frame the size of a shed erected without nails or walls or the use of any modern tools beyond a mallet and pegs. They have 1 hour to do it.
Somehow we've got to figure what all those loads are and apply them to the structure and then come up with the member forces. Members, do you remember?
Colonel Mullen, dressed in camo, is joined by his longtime friend and timber framer, Bob Smith, long hair, ponytail. Smith owns a small building company in Lexington. Together, they're teaching the cadets a centuries-old craft in which a minimum of pre-cut heavy timbers locked together with wooden pegs to form a structure. Think of it as old-timey artisanal construction. It's very natural and very strong.
You know, up until 1850, timber framing was just called carpentry because that's what it was. And then they invented wire nails.
In some ways, timber framing is not what some of these engineering cadets thought they'd be learning at a place like VMI. It's so pre-industrial. But that was exactly Colonel Mullen's point.
A number of them have been exposed to normal stick construction.
Stick construction. That's what timber framers call structures made with those newfangled nails and a whole bunch of smaller 2x4s. You know, sticks.
Okay, yeah, you cut things to length, you nail it together. The timber framing is odd.
A timber-framed home costs roughly 30% more than conventional construction, says Bob. But aesthetically, it can't be beat.
There's a richness to it. When you walk into a timber frame home, it just excites your senses. It's beautiful to look at. It's inviting to touch. And depending on how fresh it is, there's even a great smell.
Every spring since 1997, VMI's Timber Framing Club, under the direction of Colonel Mullen and his wife Cindy Mullen, spearheads a philanthropic building project somewhere around the community. Timber-framed picnic and shade shelters, pergolas, softball dugouts. Every year, the projects grow bigger and more involved, with seasoned timber framers flying in from all over the place, England, Canada, Boston, to help out. Crews have grown from 60 to 150. And if you think that means the nonprofits hosting the builds funds 150 hotel rooms, think again.
Nope. That means a flat, dry place to throw down a sleeping bag. You know, the back creaks a little more in the morning when you sleep on the floor.
What do all these skilled artisans not affiliated with Lexington get out of it? Experience, camaraderie, and the chance to timber frame.
We bring different cultures and different age groups together. And it's something that a lot of people don't have another outlet or another opportunity to experience.
All I promise them is that we will work them very hard and feed them, and they keep coming back.
The annual builds are a display of cultures colliding, clean-cut military types like Colonel Mullen swinging mallets and hauling timber with, quote, aging hippies, his words, not mine, like Bob. Again, that's part of Colonel Mullen's master plan.
Another of the sneaky ideas with doing the timber framing was to introduce the cadets to people like Bob, who are very skilled, but not through a college degree program. But if you're going to be any good as an engineer, you got to be smart enough to shut the heck up and listen every now and then. And there are people out there that have a whole lot to teach you that aren't in your formal educational process.
So we have a lot of people like Bob that teach us how to, not only how to use the tools, but also how to, like, see what looks right, what doesn't look right.
That's senior Michaela Wright, a civil engineering major and one of the leaders of the Timber Framing Club.
We cut all the wood by hand, like with chisels and hammers and all that fun stuff.
It all started back in the mid-90s when a visiting history professor specializing in medieval artillery approached Colonel Mullen about building a trebuchet. That's the fancy way of saying catapult.
We got a bunch of aging hippies to help us build a weapon, which kind of tweaked their karma a bit. And so after that, we've been doing public service projects ever since to square ourselves away with the aging hippies.
For WMRA News, I'm Jesse Nadler.
If you're on Medicare, you're probably carrying around an ID card that also includes your Social Security number. That's a problem that everybody in Washington says they want to fix, but it's taking longer than some would like. Virginia Public Radio's Michael Pope has the story.
Those Medicare cards that include Social Security numbers may be putting seniors at risk of identity theft. That's why Congress passed a bill last year to replace those Social Security numbers with randomly generated ID numbers. But that hasn't happened yet, and that frustrates Republican Congressman Dave Brett.
There's just kind of inertia behind the way programs have always worked. But when cyber attacks are getting hit and Hillary and the DNC are getting hit, I mean, I don't care what party you're in. It's like, hello, wake up. We're in the 21st century.
Hold on, says Lorraine Ryan, spokeswoman for the federal agency that oversees Medicare and Medicaid. She says they've already identified 75 different databases that need to be coordinated, things like the railroad retirement system with Social Security, for example.
We're taking the necessary time that it takes for this to be successful.
Ryan says they plan to replace the cards by April 2019. That's the deadline in the law.
It may seem like a long time, but I would like to say that we are definitely moving with alacrity to really successfully implement the large and very complex initiative.
That means for now, about a million Medicare ID cards are floating around Virginia, potential targets for identity thieves and hackers. That's until the new cards are issued sometime in the next 3 years. I'm Michael Pope.
I'm Chanel Varani, and this is Our Island Universe. Take a picture of the sun at the exact same time every few days or so for the entire year. What's the pattern that emerges from that project? You might think that because the Earth is tilted, it would be a straight line that goes up and down. The bottom of the line would correspond to the date of the winter solstice, and the top of that line would correspond to the summer solstice. Instead, you'll find that the sun traces out a figure eight over the course of a year. This shape is called the analemma. Flip it onto its side, and you get the infinity symbol. The shape the sun traces over the course of a year is not an up-down line because the motion of our planet around the sun is not a circle. Instead, it's an ellipse. Moreover, the speed at which our planet revolves around the sun is not constant. We travel fastest when we are closest in early January, and we travel the slowest when we are furthest away from the sun in early July. That the shape of our orbit is not a circle and that our speed is not constant are known as Kepler's first and second law, respectively. Johannes Kepler made these discoveries some 500 years ago. Think about it. Imagine if our ancestors, thousands of years ago, just took a selfie of the sun every few days over an entire year, so much information would be staring back at them, providing them with details about their rocket ship through space. I am Chanel Varani, director of the John C. Wells Planetarium at James Madison University.
Support for WMRA's News and Information Fund, which makes our award-winning coverage possible, is provided by Bib and Dolly Frazier, Les and Johnny Grady, Eugene Stoltzfus Architects, Joy Loving, Janet Trettner, the Just Pax Fund, an anonymous donor, and by a grant from a donor-advised fund of the Community Foundation of Harrisonburg and Rockingham County. If you'd like to learn more about how we fund our news and how you can help, go to WMRA.org, mouse over news, then click on News and Information Fund. Find all of our stories from the newsroom at WMRA.org. Be sure to click like on Facebook at WMRA Public Radio and follow me on Twitter at WMRA News to get the latest on our coverage. I'm Bob Levicki, WMRA's News Director and Morning Edition host. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday and stay tuned.